Well, this is the interactive portion of the program. We're going to take your phone calls with Mike Heiser when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Here we are back with Mike Heiser and your phone calls. Mike, as you look at everything out there with the portent, is there a message? Is there a warning? Is there something we should be aware of?
Yeah, I would say what you know may not be so.
I agree with
that. I think we really need to try to avoid being sort of locked in to our traditions and the typical way that we, you know, are taught to process things and do a little more thinking, do a little more analysis, again, of, you know, what's available to us. There's a lot of information out there. And so that is an underlying current to the portent.
Got to ask you this, too. In the facade, you talk about the serpent in Eden. You said it was not a snake. What was it?
Yeah, I don't believe that the serpent, the Hebrew term is nakash. I don't believe that we're talking about a member of the animal kingdom. I think there are clues in the text, namely, hey, the thing talks, that we're dealing with a divine being that either assumed that form or some sort of serpentine form, but it's not just a normal member of the animal kingdom. Using that strategy, you know, to have a divine being come and portray himself, you know, as something that's known, you know, to a human being, that's actually something fairly common in ancient texts in the Bible and outside. So that's what I mean by that. It's just not appearances can be deceiving.
They sure can. Okay, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Rick in Las Vegas to get things started west of the Rockies. Rick, you're on with Mike Heiser. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going, fellas?
Good,
wanted to bring to the table, I like the information that he's definitely presenting. And as well, I wanted to ask him, has he heard of a person called Tariq Nashad? It's a man, I read a book, it was called Hidden Colors. He's got three different versions. But he also talks about some of the alien context, and also talks about the African civilization that was lost and hidden. Predominantly talks about some of the religion that was manipulated and misconstrued back in the ancient world of Egyptians, that there was particular black descent, and how the Vatican pretty much kind of manipulated and twisted a lot of hidden information with the misinterpretation of Yeshua, which was Jesus, and many other names that they tried to classify under those regulations. And I would just take my answer off the air. Thanks a lot, fellas.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, the church, Michael, did manipulate. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, which is another reason why I like my Christianity to come from the text, not from an institution or a tradition. I have not heard of the specific author that he mentioned and the book. The other part, I can comment on the Egyptian part. I take a pretty low view of what we would, I guess, nowadays in academia call Afrocentrism. But what I mean by that is, I think the sort of the effort to see African civilization as being sort of the core catalyst, you know, to Western civilization, I think that's quite an exaggeration and an overstatement. But at the same time, there's no doubt in my mind that institutionally, a lot of what he described as far as, again, just sort of leaving African civilization out of the picture, that certainly has happened. But I think it's sort of an overreaction on the other end. For instance, in Egypt, we know from Egyptian artwork that the Egyptians did not consider themselves, an older term. They did not consider themselves Negroid in terms of race. And we know that because they portray the Libyans, for example, visually different than they portrayed themselves, and you know, often unfavorably, because Egypt was often at war with Libya and whatnot. But there were, you know, later in Egyptian history, I mean, you have whole civilizations and eventually a pharaonic period that was African, you know, so, and that just tends to, you know, to sort of be forgotten. But, you know, so I don't think we need to overreact to give that civilization their due.
Can we call you comfortably a skeptic, Michael?
I would say I'm someone who wants to believe, you know, in a number of different things. But again, I want to know that my belief is based on, you know, good solid data. So, you know, I want real data. I want something that's really supportable. You know, I don't like to speculate. You know, so in that respect, yeah, you know, I have a real hunger, you know, for something that's really solid, so that I can know my decisions, you know, what to believe this or believe that, you know, has some basis, you know, in reality.
Sure. Let's go to Virginia Beach, Virginia. Michael's with us. East. Michael, hi.
Hi, and thank you so much. I have a question, but before I ask it, a preliminary question. Dr. Heiser, have you heard about the Jordan books, the 70 books in metal that supposedly date back to the time of Christ and the original apostles, scientifically confirmed through... I forget the word I'm looking for right now, but anyway, we've carbon dated them or something to that effect to know that they go back to that time. And according to David Elkington on this program, when he first broke the news, those books discovered almost 3 years ago now, in December of 2011, those books, he said, probably contained the original autographs of the 12 disciples, or at least some of them, and quite possibly even original autographs of Jesus Christ himself. Now, is there a conspiracy, in your opinion, to keep these books from the general Christian population of the world? And then I'll have a follow-up question.
The short answer is no. The 70, the lead codices that you're referring to, have actually been the subject of several academic conferences, you know, that I've been to. So they have gotten attention. They're certainly not the things that you described about autographs of Jesus or the apostles or anything like that. And they actually don't claim to be that either. So that's something that sort of has accrued to them by, you know, people who are interested in them. A lot of the content has been found elsewhere, you know, in other texts that were already known to exist, which strongly suggests, you know, forgery. That's the kind of thing that scholars look for when they look for the content. And okay, does this show up in any other text that someone could have copied? And you know, in this case, there's a lot of condemning, you know, evidence for that. So that these have actually gotten a good bit of attention. Usually, the norm is that scholars tend to ignore stuff, you know, if it doesn't interest them or they're not going to, you know, be publishing about it. But this is actually a quite a different case. So they've gotten a lot of attention, and the reason that it hasn't filtered down or, you know, been earth-shattering is because, you know, they're just nobody's really buying it. I mean, from all sorts of traditions. And when I say conferences, I'm not talking about, you know, confessional, you know, sort of gatherings where people have certain theological commitments to defend. I'm talking across the spectrum, from people who are atheists all the way to the people, you know, who would be, you know, quote unquote Bible believers. I don't know anybody in the academy that works in this kind of material that, is really buying the lead codices.
All right, let's go to your follow-up question, Michael. Go ahead.
Okay, well, very quickly, I really, you you really have put even more doubt in my mind about the possibility of a conspiracy. I'm very disappointed in your answer. I hope, I think it'll be a 75 million member audience when it happens. I hope that George will arrange a three-night debate on this issue. I think David Elkington should be brought on as soon as possible to respond to what Michael Heiser just said, and whatever it takes to keep Michael Heiser in an income, because I think he's afraid of losing it if he comes out on this issue, as I've seen him do on others in the past.
My income is in no way related to the lead codices. You know, this is the kind of thing that scholars want to find. You know, that they go crazy over manuscripts, and they this is why they do what they do. You know, there's a wide spectrum of attachment to religion and theology. Again, ranging from people who just don't care at all about it to people who would care about it. I actually have a friend who is responsible for the website that has accumulated not only the news stories on these codices, but has created a hub for links to the study of the codices, whether that be, you know, analysis of materials and texts and paleography and all that sort of stuff. If George wanted to, you know, have a show on that at some point, if it made sense, I would certainly be willing to come on. But I think a better guest would be this guy. His name is Dan McClellan, and you can find his hub, you know, on the web. It's an excellent website, and it's pretty up to date. But this has been sort of out of circulation for the last 3 or 4 years, so I don't know that anybody has really done anything more recently than that. But Dan's site is really excellent for this.
Michael, because you know you're so staunch with the texts, the Nephilim that were, you know, the Genesis was mentioning, mm-hmm. they must have been something. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, I don't have any trouble, you know, believing that there were unusually tall, you know, people back in biblical times and things like that. What I don't believe, again, because the text doesn't support it, and also in this case, archaeology doesn't support it. I don't think we're talking about people that are 10, 15 feet tall. I think they're the same unusual height range that would be, you know, anomalous today. You know, some people get over 8 feet tall. I don't have any difficulty believing that. You know, it's a fairly straightforward, you know, kind of thing. For people who, in the audience who are interested in this sort of thing, in February or March, I'm actually coming out with a hefty nonfiction book called The Unseen Realm, and the subtitle is Rediscovering the Supernatural Narrative, Supernatural Worldview of the Bible, and I devote a lot of time to things like the Nephilim and the sons of God and things like that. So, you know, when that comes out, you know, I will blog about it. People will be able to hear about it, but I devote a lot of space to this issue.
All right, let's go to our first time caller now, Michael M. in San Antonio, Texas. M., go ahead.
Yes, sir. I have a lot of questions for you, actually.
Unfortunately, you're only going to get a few, but
go ahead. That's absolutely fine. But just so we get it on the air, I know I've got a few people following me on this. I am a fan of Zechariah Sitchin. I absolutely love his work. May he rest in peace. Now, to the point, when you said earlier that there is no credible evidence for extraterrestrial existence, basically, did you mean to sweep the experiences of hundreds of abductees over the past 50 years under the rug?
No, I think what they're reporting is they're being very honest. I'm actually with people, abduction researchers like Leah Haley on this, Dolores Cannon, I think to some degree, and others.
Who just, by the way, she just passed away.
I know. Yeah, I saw that.
Okay.
But they think predominantly that this is something that is perpetrated, you know, in a sinister fashion by people on other people, and you're dealing with, you know, screen memories, you're dealing with, you know, implanted memories. I mean, Leah still is a major figure in abduction research, and she has done a complete 180. She is an abductee. If you wanted to read her story, you know, her journey, so to speak, the UFO Trail, it's a blog that's excellent, chronicles that. But no, I don't discount what they're saying. I don't think they're lying. I don't think they're trying to deceive or anything like that. I think something is done to them. I think there's room for a supernatural, you know, explanation here too. I do think people are, for lack of a better term, demonized, but I think that's the minority of cases. I think my labs, you know, that's Leah's view, is a lot of this. You know, some of it could be, you know, other explanations too. But for me, what I need is I need to know that there are extraterrestrials out there first. If I knew that, then that is definitely on the table when it comes to stuff like this. But I can't use one mystery to say I'm proving another mystery, and that it's just not coherent. But I don't think that has anything specifically to do with Zechariah Sitchin's work or ufology, you know, more broadly speaking. I tend to distinguish ufology from ancient aliens, from abductions, and that I'm not unusual in that respect. A lot of people who are interested in UFO studies do that. I don't think they're all interdependent. They're certainly interrelated in terms of conversation, but I don't think they're interdependent.
What's it going to take, Michael, to get this possible story out about ufology, that we're being visited? What's it going to take?
You know, that used to be an easy question for me. I mean, what my a few years ago, I would have said, what I need is a biological entity. I mean, an undisputed,
a physical
here it
specimen.
Is, peer review this thing to death. You know, this is a biological life form that ain't human. That used to be easy. The problem with it now are things like synthetic biology. You know, and I this is, again, part of the portent. Again, the portent is your cornucopia of coast-to-coast topics. But with synthetic biology, that means we not only can read a DNA sequence, but we can make one. You know, from the atomic level on up, we can actually create life forms that have never existed on the planet and use elements in combination that are unknown on the planet. In other words, if I had this technological capability, and right now it's one of those things, and this is so common, you know, for the coast-to-coast audience to hear, it's one of those things that is on the drawing board, and people are tinkering with it at a very small level. And in theory, if you master this technology, you know, you come out at this fantastic godlike power. And that bothers me, because if we have that capability and we ever get to that point, somebody could just make one, and it wouldn't be real. It would be real, but not real. You know what I mean? And so again, it used to be an easy answer for me, but the more I read in synthetic biology, it's like, oh, great. You know, that security in that particular answer, you know, that would have nailed it down for me is just like vapor now.
Michael, we're going to come back and take some final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Having a love affair with your car? Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, we'll be talking about the latest innovations with driverless functioning cars. We'll have some fun, too, on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back with Mike Heiser and your final calls as well. And, Michael, let's go right to the calls. We'll go to West Palm Beach, Florida. Mike's with us. Mike, you're on with Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, how you doing? Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Ben Rich, Benrich, was head of the Lockheed Skunk Works for many years. He did the original research on the stealth technology. He died 20 years ago. You can look it up on Google. They have a whole thing, Ben Rich, Lockheed, ET. He made several deathbed statements before he died. Two of the statements were very interesting. One statement was that he was using ET technology to develop the stealth program. The second statement he said was that the U.S. military has used ET technology to build ships, starships, And the military has been out there investigating the SARS. Two statements. Now, is there any truth in this? And this is what I discovered. I think he's absolutely correct. You heard of the Kepler Space Telescope, of course, everybody, right? Supposedly, here on Earth, this Kepler in orbit is taking pictures or amplifying these suns and able to discover, according to the astronomers, 2,000 Earth-like planets in the last 6 years. So they're telling us that the Kepler could look out 1,000 light years into space and measure the size of the planet, distance from the sun, and so forth. And I think this is nonsense. This is ridiculous what they're telling us. I think the astronomers are telling us the truth, but they're not getting it from Kepler. They're getting it from our own people out there or alien technology or whatever, or what happened. Now, here's an interesting story. For years, we couldn't figure out the size of Pluto from Earth's telescopes here. We couldn't understand what the hell was going on with this particular planet until we sent a satellite out there to photograph it. Then we knew the story. But on the other hand, they tell us with Kepler, we can measure out things 1,000 miles into space. And I'm saying is that this is a game they're playing here. And I don't believe anything the astronomers are telling us, that they're losing that Kepler and they're getting Earth-like. Wait, what is an Earth-like planet anyway? According to them, it's distance from the sun. What if it means other things like water, atmosphere, life? That's what I think they really found out. And our people are out there feeding back information to the astronomers here who are reporting it and claiming they get it from Kepler. That's my thing about it.
Well, there's a lot there to think about, Michael.
Was there a question?
No, just a statement.
Well, I'm not an astronomer, so, you know, I can't evaluate an astronomical conspiracy. I know two astronomers, and this is what they would live for, you know, to have proof of alien life. So I don't know how it's coherent to say that they would be deceiving people into believing the very thing that they want to believe themselves. Maybe I didn't follow the statement as well as I should have, but I can't evaluate it. It just doesn't make any sense to me, because the astronomers I know, this is what they want. You know, and if they had something about it, especially the astronomical community, it's one of the most ungoverned communities, because anybody with a telescope who has a reasonable amount of astronomical knowledge, they can see things. You know, they can't possibly be policed. There's millions of people around the world with telescopes. I mean, if somebody had something, even from another source, to me that validates, you know, what they live for. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but maybe I didn't understand it.
Why is there so much distrust out there, Michael? Distrust with everything. Science, government, everything.
You know, I think in our day and age, there's a general distrust of authority structures. You know, we all know the political examples and the very poor history politically, which the first guest you had on tonight actually got into some of that.
Yeah.
You know, it really undermines a lot of things that, you know, you want to depend on. And when one authority structure goes, then it seems like another, you know, the whole religious world, either with bad ethics, you know, mistreatment of people, bad thinking, you know, I think in our day and age, it sort of gets exponentially ramped up because of the internet. And what I mean by that is we have so much access to information, where some of these things that would sort of trickle out over time now are almost instantaneous, you know, and it really undermines a lot of things. And that's not a statement against, you know, access to information. I think it's just the reality. And I wish it would make people be more honest. Maybe it will, or maybe it will in the long run.
One day. Kyla's in Chicago now. Kyla, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Dr. Heiser. Great show.
Hi.
Thank you.
Hi. So I have a theory, kind of about Jesus and a question. I was wondering if you had ever heard of the Tzaddik or the Tzaddikim from the Old Testament. I believe the number is 36, and with that, there can only be 36 on this earth at one time. They have to born and die at like the same moment. They were known to be able to perform miracles like turning water into wine, making barren women pregnant, even walking on water, and they could also change their appearance. And I think other than like Jesus's sort of gregariousness that the Jewish people sort of frowned upon at that time and ever led, unfortunately, to the crucifixion, is that tzaddiks were very revered in the community and typically lived humbly and as hermits outside the community. And so they weren't really well known and would perform miracles just for anybody. So I was wondering if you had heard about that.
What was the term you used?
It's a tzaddik, or the 36 tzaddikim, which would be Hebrew.
Okay. Tzaddikim. You know, I haven't heard of that in connection with biblical studies. I've heard things like that in relation to like Kabbalistic studies and things like that, which aren't the same thing, obviously, even though, you know, both of them are concerned with the Hebrew Bible. So that's the best I can answer that. In terms of the content of the Hebrew Bible itself, you don't have, you know, the idea that there are 36 of these, but it, you know, there's Jewish tradition, you know, to that effect.
Have you found, Michael, that, you know, script of a Bible, Buddhists, Hebrew, all of them are just interconnected, that they talk about the same principles?
I think when it comes to ethics, there's a good deal of overlap. You know, how we should treat each other and, you know, our bodies and relationships, you know, human relationships, that sort of thing. So when it comes to those sorts of areas, I think there is a considerable amount of consensus, you know, high degree anyway. I mean, there are differences. When it comes to, like, doctrine, in other words, the content of a religion in terms of making propositional statements, you know, truth assertions, that kind of thing, there's actually the opposite. It's quite varied, you know, and even in some cases just bluntly oppositional. So it depends on, you know, which area, you know, you're talking about.
Let's go to Augustus in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania now. Good morning, Augustus. Go ahead.
I'm a biblical researcher. I have a book of my own. It's 800 pages. The title is Eternity Now, in reference to the biblical writers with Origen of Alexandria, Emanuel Swedenborg, and Thomas Troward. So here's a question I would ask of you, and I'll give you some references. The practical utility of what you are doing on the Bible, which is a collection of ancient texts by many writers. Some of these texts are plainly erroneous. Some of them are still of practical value. Are you familiar with Thomas Troward and his book, Bible Mystery and Bible Meaning? It's, in my opinion, the best book in the Bible by anyone. The first sentence in the book begins, "The Bible is the book of the emancipation of man." And that turned me on very much to doing biblical research, although I had a minor in Bible.
What was his name again, Augustus?
Thomas Troward. As far as I know, this is the first time in your broadcast anybody has mentioned him, and he is of major importance.
Have you heard of him, Michael?
No, I haven't heard of him, but what's the spelling?
T-R-O-W-A-R-D, Thomas, 1847 to 1916. He was independent. He was not a theologian. Didn't belong to any particular church, although his background was Anglican. And he was a lifelong study of the Bible. He even went to the original languages. The book is fascinating and very, extremely well written. I even did a recording of it.
All right, well, that's one for you to check out, Michael Heiser.
Yeah, I would not. I mean, I'm not biased toward mid 20th century work. So let me preface what I'm going to say by that, because a lot of good scholarship, you know, happened before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the scrolls were so significant both in terms of the textual history of the Hebrew Bible, how we got it, and in many cases what it actually says, and, you know, just the conceptual content of certain things, that if you're working without that material, you're at a real distinct disadvantage. But, you know, again, I recognize that there's a lot of good work done before that, so I'll look up the author's name.
We've got Lewis now in Pierce, Kentucky. Thanks for calling, Lewis. Go ahead.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi there.
I'll tell you what, this gentleman has, people have run him through the complete gambit of all conversation tonight.
They sure have.
So much so that I don't even know if my question is pertaining to the conversation he's running, but I'll say it anyway. When I first tuned in, you were talking about the Revelation 12, the woman in Revelation chapter 12, about the went out and the beast chased her, the dragon chased her, she had her child in the desert. But I was wondering if you'd ever looked at the connection, the descriptive connections that may be there between the woman in Revelation chapter 17, and when she, the woman riding the beast, and her description, and the horns and the stars around her head that, you know, represented the nations, and if there would be any connection that you would see there with the symbols that the European Union used with their, on their flag and everything, with a woman riding the beast and the stars, so X number of stars representing the countries around her head.
That would be for you, Michael.
Yeah, well, as far as the two women in chapters 12 and 17, I mean, they're clearly different, because the woman in Revelation 12 gives birth to the Messiah. But I know what you're angling for here, because the counterpart in 17, you know, the whore of Babylon and whatnot, with connections to to an Antichrist figure, is sort of a perverse mirror image, you know, that kind of thing. You know, I don't put, how can I say this?
Diplomatically.
Diplomatically. I mean, I don't really like any of the end times systems that are really, you know, circulating within the church. I mean, I have my own sort of positions on certain things. So I tend to not look at Revelation as being something that we can pick up a newspaper or like a modern history book and interpret Revelation by that. But, you know, I recognize that not everything fits into an earlier context either. So I think, again, the rule of thumb, George asked earlier, how do we interpret the Bible? My rule of thumb is, what would have been in the thinking, in the mind of the ancient writer, first of all, and it certainly isn't 20th century, 21st century Europe. That doesn't mean there might not be a conceptual connection, but I don't think we can use that as sort of a direct interpretive tool, you know, for figuring out what's going on in Revelation. I think the point there is either Babylon or Rome, and the polar opposition to Israel, and of course the mother of the Messiah. So it's a very colorful way of at the very least talking about, you know, good versus evil, God versus, you know, the devil, and again, you know, your polar oppositions and that kind of thing.
Do you think the Bible is factual, Michael?
Oh, I certainly think a lot of it is factual. And I answer it that way because we need to make a distinction between things that the Bible asserts as points of truth as opposed to sort of worldview baggage that the author, you know, would have had. For instance, let me give you an example. If you take the Bible literally, you know, you come out with a round, flat earth, you know, that there's a dome affixed over it, and the stars are affixed to the dome and all that kind of stuff. And there are a number of passages in Proverbs and Job that talk about the mirror of the sky being hard as brass and all that kind of stuff. Well, that's obviously not a scientific statement, but a person who had that worldview, nevertheless, can still write about things and assert, you know, things that, you know, are true, that can certainly be factually true. You know, I think we have to separate the limitations of the author from the actual truth statements that are made in Scripture.
Michael, not a lot of time left, and I wanted you to at least get some of your websites out and your works. If people want to pick up The Portent, where do they pick it up at?
Well, they can go to my main page, which is Dr., as in doctor, MSH. Those are my initials, drmsh.com. There's a nice-looking slider there that you can click on the cover of the books and get there that way, or they can go to readtheportent.com or readthefacade.com, and you'll wind up at the same place. I should add real quickly that I was able during the break to update my research links page include Leah Haley's work on abductions, and there's an excellent article I linked to dealing with abductions and U.S. mind control programs like MKUltra. Again, some of the same figures in that program show up in the Betty and Barney Hill case. Again, that's too much of a coincidence for me.
There are and no also, coincidences. As you know.
Also, the lead codices, I put a link on that. That's at the bottom of the research links page. So people go to drmsh.com, scroll down an inch or so, you'll see the link to the research material and also the slider or the pull-down menus for the books. It'll be easy to find.
Michael, thanks for being on the program. Truly appreciate it. Michael Heiser. For Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.